The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mary Grace Payton for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the New York Times News Service, News and Observer, and the Religion News Service. First of all, an article published on June 13 by the New York Times News Service entitled, Southern Baptists Reject Tighter Ban on Female Pastors. Indianapolis. Southern Baptists rejected a move to crack down on congregations with women in pastoral leadership. The vote dealt an unexpected rebuke to a hard right faction that has been jockeying for influence in the country's largest Protestant denomination. The amendment that was put to vote Wednesday at the denomination's annual meeting in Indianapolis would have added language to the denomination's constitution saying that only men could be affirmed or employed as any kind of pastor or elder as qualified by Scripture. The amendment's language echoes the Southern Baptist statement of faith. Adding the language to the denomination's constitution would have strengthened enforcement and, its proponents say, would have streamlined the denomination's ability to oust individual churches that employ women with titles like children's pastor. With almost 13 million church members across the United States, the Southern Baptist Convention has long been a bellwether for American evangelicalism. Its reliably conservative membership makes it a powerful political force, and its debates have attracted widespread interest from outside commentators and politicians this year. The convention also elected a new president Wednesday morning, Clint Presley, pastor of Hickory Grove Baptist Church in North Carolina. He is an establishment conservative who has pledged to tamp down heightened rhetoric among Southern Baptists, and he supported the amendment. On Tuesday, delegates voted overwhelmingly to expel a church in Virginia that has a female pastor for women and children. For opponents of the amendment, the expulsion showed that the existing system for keeping women out of the pulpit was effective and the amendment was not needed. Last year, Southern Baptist ejected five churches with female lead or senior pastors, including one of its most prominent congregations, Saddleback Church in Southern California. We have shown that the mechanisms that we currently have are sufficient to deal with this question, Spence Shelton, a pastor in North Carolina, said from the floor in opposition to the amendment. He pointed out that recently ousted churches include a small church, a very large one, and a historic one, suggesting that Southern Baptists are not afraid to take decisive action. For the amendment's vocal boosters, opposition to women pastors draws a line in the sand against the encroachment of more sweeping signs of progressivism, including acceptance of homosexuality and transgender identities. If we compromise our message, we will corrode our mission, Mike Law, the pastor in Virginia who proposed the amendment, said at a lunch meeting that concluded in prayer for the amendment's passage. If we want the big ship of the Southern Baptist Convention to go for the long haul, a little leak is not okay, and the leak is growing. In their view, slow-moving and scattershot expulsions of churches that employ women as head pastors was not sufficient for such a core issue. Now a related article about the new president that was published by the News and Observer on June 18 and written by Joe Marisak. Newly elected Southern Baptist president from Charlotte opposes women as pastors. The Reverend Clint Presley woke up Thursday morning praying for the Southern Baptist Convention, he told his 9,000 followers on social media site X. Pray I don't embarrass us, the 55-year-old Charlotte pastor quipped. The morning before, Presley was elected president of the nation's largest Protestant denomination, during its annual meeting in Indianapolis. The longtime pastor of Hickory Grove Baptist Church topped a field of six candidates. He won a second runoff ballot with 56% of the vote over Dan Spencer, pastor of First Baptist Church in Sevierville, Tennessee. Congratulations soon poured in for the Charlotte native, including on social media from his megachurch. "I love my church, man," Presley replied. Presley was elected at a controversial time for the denomination. At its annual meeting, the convention voted to oppose in vitro fertilization and nearly voted to penalize Southern Baptist churches that have women ministers. During a post-election news conference Wednesday, Presley addressed divisive issues facing the convention while saying, "There's a lot to celebrate in the Southern Baptist Convention, especially as it points to biblical fidelity, real clear mission focus." I think that's part of what the president's job is, to do all you can by way of influence to make sure, as a convention of churches, we are focused on what our mission is, he said. So I look forward to next year. It's a great time to celebrate. Who is new Southern Baptist president? Presley and his wife, Connie, live in Mint Hill and have two sons. Their third and youngest son, Nate, 24, died from a probable drug overdose in his apartment on August 19, 2023, Clint Presley said on social media the next day. Nate has been in the far country for a couple of years now, and we have prayed for him every day, Presley said on X. The Lord is kind. We trust providence. Far country was a biblical reference to the prodigal son. Pastors and ministers from across Baptist life expressed their sympathies and support for the Presleys, the Biblical Recorder reported at the time. As a boy, Clint Presley belonged to the Presbyterian Church, USA. During Wednesday's news conference, Presley recalled how his life changed when his family switched to a Southern Baptist church. "Never heard anything like that," he said. His family joined Hickory Grove when Presley was a teenager, according to his biography on the church website. He graduated from Wofford College in Spartanburg, South Carolina, with a Bachelor of Arts degree and obtained his Master of Divinity from New Orleans Baptist Theological Seminary. He pastored two churches in Mississippi and returned to Hickory Grove in 1999 as Senior Associate Pastor of Preaching. In 2004, he left to become Senior Pastor of historic Dauphin Way Baptist Church in Mobile, Alabama, and returned to Hickory Grove in 2010 as co-pastor. A year later, he was installed as Senior Pastor. Presley has held volunteer leadership roles with the convention since 2013, when he was vice president of its pastors conference. He was first vice president of the convention in 2014-15 and has been a trustee of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary since 2015. He's been on the North Carolina Baptist Board of Directors since last year. Presley said he's glad to serve as president, but said it's also a volunteer position, meaning he'll need help running the annual convention. "It sounds like you have a whole lot of power, but you don't," he told reporters. Amendment to ban women pastors fails. Presley said he supported the failed law amendment, which would have barred churches that have women pastors. "I thought it provided really great clarity," he told reporters. "I have brothers that are just as theologically robust as I, who also were against it. Then we have maintained a real sense of God's good design, not only in marriage, but how he's given us to live as men and women," Presley said. "Still, Southern Baptists can remain united despite such differences," he said. "We need to be unified around not only our understanding of the Bible and our love for the Bible, love for the gospel, love for the mission," he said. We are unified around the Baptist faith and message that we affirm. So there's a lot we can really be glad of, he said. You walk away with the law amendment not passing, but we have not abandoned biblical truth at all. Presley also addressed sexual abuse. An investigation by the Houston Chronicle and San Antonio Express News in 2019 exposed sexual abuse in the Southern Baptist Convention. I think you can be really confident, as you've seen in the last couple of years, that the Southern Baptist Convention takes sexual abuse terribly seriously, and that people have worked really hard, he said. And he responded to the passage of a resolution that warned about the ethics of in vitro fertilization. He said he and his wife had thought about that and other options when dealing with infertility. Pastors should use the resolution to help Southern Baptists think through the issue, he said. We have just not thought about it very much, he said. Presley was traveling Thursday and could not be reached by the Charlotte Observer. Next, an article published by the News and Observer on June the 17th, entitled Reverend William Barber's New Book on White Poverty Shows Breadth of an American Crisis by Martha Quinlan. As election year ads and social media campaigns focus on politicians' personalities, Reverend William J. Barber II and other advocates for the poor want voters to look instead at policies they say divide Americans and help keep too many of them in poverty. Barber, a North Carolina pastor, lecturer, co-founder of the Poor People's Campaign, and president of Repairers of the Breach, and writer Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove, released a book this week called White Poverty: How Exposing Myths About Race and Class Can Reconstruct American Democracy. The Poor People's Campaign and other groups plan a rally in Washington later this month. Why does the book focus on white poverty? Barber and Wilson Hartgrove say politicians continue to use a decades-old strategy of dividing Americans by suggesting that black, brown, and white people have competing interests. Because if poor people realized how much they have in common, they would unite around shared concerns and force elected officials to respond to their needs. Barber has said the technique is used by corrupt politicians as a distraction that allows them to craft policies benefiting the wealthiest people in society at the expense of the poorest. Barber said in an interview there were 87 million poor and low-wage people in the United States who were eligible to vote in the last presidential election. But about some 30 million of them didn't go to the polls. Today, Barber said, there are 135 million poor and low-wage people in the country, 66 million of whom are white, and if they vote, their numbers could affect the outcome of local, state, and national elections. We're calling them the new swing vote, Barber said, adding that in every state, if poor and low-wage voters increase participation by 25%, they could fundamentally affect elections. Their participation is crucial, Barber said, because those voters tend to hold progressive views on the federal minimum wage, access to health care, affordable housing, funding for education, and other issues that affect them. Poverty is interracial. It's not a black issue or a white issue. It's an American issue and an American crisis, Barber said. Why do so many poor people not vote? Barber says many of them don't believe elections have any impact on their lives. In debates, he said, politicians don't discuss how their policies would affect the poor. Nobody talks to them or about them, Barber said, despite research showing that poverty and social factors associated with it are a leading cause of death in the United States. What's the June 29 Moral March on Washington? Barber said organizers, including faith and labor groups from across the country are preparing for tens of thousands of people to participate in the mass poor people's and low-wage workers' assembly and moral march on Washington on June 29. The rally is meant to draw attention to the movement's 17-point agenda, encourage solidarity among the poor, regardless of race, and inspire people to vote in the November election. The event also will be live-streamed, and Barber said more than a million people are expected to tune in. Our last article for today was published by the Religion News Service on May 30, written by Catherine Post, and entitled, Adults Raised in the Christian Parenting Empire of the 70s and 90s Pushback. For Tia Levings, it was blanket training, a method where a parent places an infant or toddler on a blanket and punishes them, often by hitting them if they stray. Blanket training was a line Levings refused to cross, and a technique that made her question the teachings that enveloped her as a young mother in the Christian patriarchy movement. We were not to listen to our instincts, said Levings, who raised her kids in Jacksonville, Florida, in the 1990s. Our mother instincts would lead us to make weak choices that cater to the flesh, and instead, we needed to raise our babies the way God would. When Levings spoke about corporal punishment in the hit documentary series Shiny Happy People, her story didn't just resonate with viewers raised in fundamentalism. Though the series focused on Bill Gothard's Institute in Basic Life Principles, the idea that spanking results in obedient, righteous children was a hallmark of mainstream evangelical parenting in the 70s through the 90s. Dobson taught people, spank your kid, but sit them down and put them on your lap and hug them, therapist Crispin Mayfield said about psychologist and Focus on the Family founder James Dobson, whose book Dare to Discipline has sold more than 3.5 million copies since 1970. The combination of pain and affection, Mayfield told RNS, can shape how children view parents and authority. And according to Mayfield and Levings, it can impact their view of God. It leaves you without any spiritual solace, said Levings, author of the forthcoming book, A Well-Trained Wife, My Escape from Christian Patriarchy. You don't know where to turn for any kind of safe spirituality because the divine was used as the justification for why you were being hurt. In the late 20th century, a specific, often white evangelical brand of authoritarian parenting emerged. Framed as being God-glorifying, it was characterized by rigid hierarchies, demands for children's immediate and cheerful obedience, and the absence of negative emotions among children. It was enforced by spanking, often starting when a child was just a few months old. Now, some of the adults raised in that context are pushing back. Leveraging social media, they aim to show that this parenting approach can result in trauma, estrangement, and a view of God as abusive. Their warnings are often paired with a plea to raise kids in a way that honors children's agency. Books like Dobson's were an explicit response to the perceived disruptions of the feminist movement, civil rights movement, Vietnam War protest, and 1960s youth culture, several experts told RNS. Evangelical authoritarian parenting prioritized parental authority as a stabilizing force, and were also an answer to parenting models seen as permissive, including those popularized by such authors as Dr. Benjamin Spock and later Dr. William Sears. As Dobson's research extended beyond the evangelical parenting world, other self-appointed experts such as Gothard, Ted Tripp, Gary Ezzo, Michael and Debbie Pearl, and Nancy Campbell emerged. Their advice proliferated via conferences and parenting books, some with provocative titles such as Larry Tomczak's God the Rod and Your Children's Bod. Or Reb Bradley's Born Liberal, Raised Right, How to Rescue America from Moral Decline. Author Marissa Burt said that, barring Dobson, most of those authors were pastors who lacked relevant credentials. They marketed themselves well. They made claims to spiritual authority. They generated fear in parents, and they presented their opinion as God's way to hundreds of thousands of people, said Burt. Together, these authors created a cohesive movement, or as Burt and scholar Kelsey Kramer McInnes say in their forthcoming book, From Brazos, A Christian Parenting Empire. These writers viewed parents as God's representatives, charged with using physical punishment to enforce instant obedience, constant composure, strict hierarchies, and gender binaries. This approach, parents were taught, would preserve the nuclear family and, by extension, society as a whole, and would prevent their children from losing their souls. Parents are being told, you have to do this, or your kid is either going to end up in hell or end up like a criminal, said R. L. Stoller, author of The Kingdom of Children. As writers D. L. and Crispin Mayfield note in their new multimedia Strong-Willed Project, these authors often rejected the authoritarian label. But the Mayfields developed the term religious authoritarian parenting to discuss those like Dobson, Gothard, and the Pearls, whose impacts and techniques, they argue, are nevertheless authoritarian in nature. It wasn't marked by having to wear skirts or, like, not going to the movies or that sort of things. It was marked by, do you submit to the authority figures in your life, Crispin Mayfield said. For many parents, the promises of this movement never materialized. Rather than a lifetime of happiness with compliant Christian children, several sources told RNS, parents in some cases have become estranged from children who eventually sought autonomy beyond the parent-child relationship. The parents feel utterly betrayed, and the only way they can handle that is by saying, I didn't do anything wrong. It's my children. They are not grateful for the sacrifices that I made, said Abby Nye, an anti-abuse advocate raised with the Quiverful ideology, often characterized by large families, homeschooling, and female submission. Parents who refuse to acknowledge the harm caused by Christian authoritarian parenting, she said, risk alienating their kids long-term. Nye is one of several Christians and former evangelicals, or ex-evangelicals, speaking out against Christian authoritarian parenting and seeking different approaches. As she teaches her son to regulate rather than stifle his emotions, she said, she draws inspiration from child liberation theology, an emerging Christian movement that says children have the same worth as adults. One of the leaders of that field is Stoller, a child of evangelical parents who were somewhat resistant adopters of some of the more authoritarian aspects of parenting, he told RNS. Now he argues in blogs and articles that adults can parent without exerting force to exact compliance. I want parents to know there are different ways to read the Bible that are valid, that understand and respect who Jesus and God are, and are still treating children in a way that is humane and respectful. Deciding to parent differently than their evangelical parents was part of what led the Mayfields to eventually depart Christianity. Their strong-willed project suggests kids raised by religious authoritarian parenting are more susceptible to political authoritarianism, including that of Donald Trump. We've been traumatized for political purposes, D.L. Mayfield told RNS. All of this was done to undo the progress made in the 1950s, and us as kids were just collateral damage. Through Strong-Willed, the Mayfields hope to build a community for those reckoning with their childhoods. As they share findings from their book research, Bert and McGinnis, both Christian parents themselves, have reached hundreds of people trying to unpack the Christian parenting empire they belong to. People who've left Christianity to tune into YouTube or Instagram to hear Bert and McGinnis discuss corporal punishment, perfectionism, and spiritual authority in Christian parenting. There's a way to talk about this that is absolutely accusing my parents' generation of being either these authoritarian spiritual tyrants or just sheep to people like James Dobson, and neither of those is true, said McGinnis, who is also a correspondent for Christianity Today. I think there's a way to talk about this that welcomes those folks, so I'm really thankful when someone from that camp chimes in. The parents and professionals analyzing the previous generation's Christian parenting are doing so amid a culture-wide shift away from punitive parenting tactics. But as gentle and conscious parenting becomes more mainstream, it can also become whitewashed, warned parenting coach Yolanda Williams, who argues that true conscious parenting, which teaches parents to be mindful of their own trauma, must reckon with how colonization interrupted indigenous parenting methods. There were reports that indigenous people were appalled by the way that the Europeans treated their children like property. Williams, creator of the Parenting Decolonized Social Media Accounts and Resources, said, "The roots of conscious parenting are from Black, Indigenous, and other people of color." But though the tides of parenting culture seem to have turned, some artifacts of Christian authoritarian parenting have remained, with new iterations gaining popularity on social media, where self-platformed experts and tradwife influencers have been doling out parenting advice in what they see as a revival of old-fashioned Christian family values. To those raised in the original Christian parenting empire, these freshly packaged lessons about obedience, discipline, and strict gender roles are grimly familiar. Whether we are ex-evangelicals, whether we still consider ourselves Christians, whether we are on the political spectrum, we're saying what we experienced was not okay, said Nye. We want to warn the next generation. We have run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News. I hope you'll listen again next time and that you've enjoyed it. I'm Mary Grace Payton, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Religion in the News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.